as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed speculation Sunday about a possible deal to free more than 200 hostages kidnapped by the militant group Hamas, conditions at the Shifa Hospital, which is the largest in Gaza, are being described as catastrophic.
All the information we're getting here is that the situation there is just terrible.
The European Union condemns stepped-up fighting in Sudan's Darfur region, warning of the danger of another genocide.
We saw the initial violence in Darfur on June 16th.
And Russian forces have ramped up attacks in eastern Ukraine in an attempt to gain ground near two key frontline cities. Today is Tuesday, November 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Kim Lewis. The Israel-Hamas war continues, and conditions at the Shifa Hospital, which is the largest in Gaza, are being described as catastrophic. VOA's Rick Pantaleo talks with Jan Boschat in East Jerusalem about this and other developments.
I guess the first thing we should talk about, Jan, is conditions at the Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest in Gaza. What is the situation with the hospital?
All the information we're getting here is that the situation there is just terrible. It's a very bad situation. Doctors there and nurses, they say they don't have power for the last 3 days. They don't have enough food and water. They don't have fuel to run the generators. They say dozens of bodies are starting to decompose inside the hospital, not only inside the morgue, but also in the different parts of the hospital because there's no space for all the dead. And also there are around 8,000 people staying there, looking for refugee there to find a safe space. And at the same time, the Israeli forces are getting really, really close, and there are battles around. Israeli forces are getting close to one of the gates of Al-Shifa Hospital. It's a big complex, a medical complex there. I've been there a few times in the past, and IDF, the Israeli forces, say that Hamas is using the hospital as a base and a command center. This information cannot be independently verified. At the same time, Hamas says they're not using the hospital as a base, and also this information cannot be independently verified. But the information we're getting from the people there is that the situation is just tragic right now.
What about talks about the hostages?
There are a lot of talks about it. A lot of countries are involved in these discussions and trying to broker a deal between Hamas and Israel. Qatar, Egypt, the U.S., they're all talking, but we don't have anything concrete so far. There's expectation that first talking about 50 hostages to be released, then 80, then 200. The truth is nothing concrete so far happened. We don't even know how many hostages are still alive. Hamas said at least 50 of them were killed during Israeli bombardment in some parts of Gaza. But this also, this information cannot be verified so far. So there's a lot of rumors about negotiations, but nothing concrete to now.
Jan, can you tell us a little bit about the evacuation of Gaza City and northern Gaza to the south? I mean, we're seeing images back here in the United States of a massive exodus from those two locations. Can you tell us about how that is progressing?
Hundreds of thousands of people are leaving Gaza City. Gaza Strip has different districts, let's say different towns like Gaza and Khan Yunis, Rafah, and some refugee camps there. Gaza City is the biggest city in Gaza Strip, is the most populated. Around 700,000 people used to live in Gaza City. Now, right now, hundreds of thousands of people that couldn't go to the south during the first phase of this ground invasion are going now. So UN says at least 500,000 people are from northern Gaza are internally displaced now in the south. And the situation is really bad there because, as you know, there are not enough food, water, electricity. So lots of people, hundreds of thousands of people are trying to flee Gaza City right now because the battles are raging there.
That was VOA's Rick Pantaleo, who spoke with Jan Boschat in East Jerusalem. As he stressed that his country will continue its military operations in Gaza until it defeats Hamas, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed speculation Sunday about a possible deal to free more than 200 hostages. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has details.
A day after dozens of Arab leaders held an emergency meeting in Saudi Arabia and strongly condemned the Israeli military offensive in Gaza, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan appeared on ABC, underlining the United States' position on Tel Aviv's war against Hamas.
We believe in the importance of the laws of war, which means taking every possible measure to protect civilians. At the same time, we will continue to stand behind the proposition that Israel has the right to defend itself against terrorist attacks.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was interviewed Sunday on CNN, was asked to comment on U.S. Secretary of State's Antony Blinken's recent remarks that too many Palestinians have been killed in Gaza.
I think any civilian loss is a tragedy, and the blame should be placed squarely on Hamas because it prevents them from leaving the war zone, sometimes at gunpoint. It fired on the safe zone and the safe corridor that we enacted.
Separately, Netanyahu addressed the speculation about a possible deal for the release of the hostages kidnapped by Hamas on October 7. His remarks aired on NBC's Meet the Press program.
Extraordinary work that the IDF is doing, putting pressure on the Hamas leadership. That's the one thing that might create a deal. And if a deal is available, well, we'll talk about it when it's there. We'll announce it if it's achieved.
The prime minister added that when the war is over, the overall military responsibility of Gaza will remain in the hands of Israel, but that it's too early to determine who will govern it.
As far as the civilian management of Gaza, we need to see the following two things. Gaza has to be demilitarized and Gaza has to be de-radicalized. Mm-hmm. And I think so far, we haven't seen any Palestinian force, including the Palestinian Authority, that is able to do it.
Meanwhile, on the ground, Palestinian civilians continued fleeing northern Gaza, as several United Nations agencies called for an immediate halt on attacks against hospitals. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
A march for Israel is scheduled to take place Tuesday on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. A news release from organizers says the purpose of the march is to demonstrate solidarity with the people of Israel, condemn rising anti-Semitic violence and harassment, and to demand that every hostage held by Hamas be immediately and safely released. Eilat, the southernmost town in Israel, became one of the main hubs for evacuees from areas under rocket barrage from Gaza since the October 7th attacks. Now the town has become the target of drone and missile attacks. VOA's Natasha Mozgovaya reports.
When sirens warn of a rocket attack, residents of Eilat in southern Israel have about 30 seconds to get a shelter. But before a drone crashed into a school last week, there was no siren, just a whirring noise followed by an explosion. Twelve-year-old Gal Harari says most students had already left the building, with about 40 inside for after-school activities. She recalls the day of the drone attack, saying, "We were preparing in the past few days, we had a lot of drills, so the students knew what to do. We were lucky that nobody got hurt. It was a real miracle." The drone, which Israel Defense Forces say came from Syria, damaged the building. There were no injuries. The Israeli resort city of Eilat was supposed to become a safe shelter for over 60,000 people evacuated from towns and villages in southern Israel that were under rocket attacks from Gaza. Yet this city became the target of ballistic missiles fired by Houthi rebels from Yemen and also drones launched from Syria. One of those drones crashed into the elementary school building. Gal's mother, Sharon Harari, says she used to tell her daughter the school is the safest place because their family home doesn't have a shelter. Sharon Harari says, "I really thought it was the safest place and that the girls need to go to their routine of studies alongside the war and continue their lives. But unfortunately, it didn't happen because there was no siren and no alert. And if this happened, anything could happen." She says the conflict is taking its toll on the children. Sharon Harari says even when the kid is not physically hurt, he's psychologically hurt. And the kids here of all ages are scared. They don't sleep at night, they're afraid to go to the restroom by themselves, they're not going to play outside. Even though it looks pastoral with the sea and everything, it's all very pretty and we are trying hard, we are scared. Last week, the Israel Defense Forces said its long-range Arrow air defense system intercepted a surface-to-surface missile over the Red Sea, launched toward Eilat. The IDF did not say who was behind the missile, although Yemen's Iran-backed Houthi rebels claimed firing ballistic missiles toward southern Israel. Darin Ray's family is among the survivors of the October 7 attack on kibbutz near Oz by Hamas, a U.S.-designated terror organization. One-fourth of the community of 400 were among the victims. At least 20 people were killed and more than 70 kidnapped. She says Hamas was inside her family's home, but couldn't break into the fortified room where she, her husband, and their three kids were hiding, holding the door for 8 hours. The family evacuated to Eilat, which now is being targeted. For the surviving Near Oz members, it will be years before they can return to their kibbutz if they decide to.
There is a plan that we go together to some place with buildings, that it's very different from our life, just for 2 or 3 years. And in the end, we're supposed to come back to the kibbutz after they will fix everything and make it renew. I don't know if I come back. Actually, I want to say that I don't come back because my kids are very scared. And also, my husband, we promised them all of their life, don't be scared. The soldiers is here. They're working as very hard for us and they will never let something happen.
On October 7th, she says, nobody came. Natasha Mozgovaya, VOA News, Eilat, Israel.
We're following these other stories from around the world. The U.S. government is once again facing a looming partial shutdown, which could occur Friday midnight if lawmakers and the White House cannot agree on a new spending plan. The latest funding dispute centers on the politically fractious House of Representatives, where Republicans hold a narrow majority but are divided among themselves on spending priorities. Rebels from Ethiopia's Oromia region said Monday they were in Tanzania for a second round of talks with the Ethiopian government to try to end decades of fighting. The conflict in recent years has killed hundreds of people and displaced tens of thousands in Ethiopia's most populous region. Donald Trump Jr. has returned to the stand in New York City as defense lawyers start calling witnesses in the civil fraud trial that threatens his father's real estate empire. Trump Jr. initially said he never worked on the annual financial statements at the heart of New York Attorney General Letitia James's lawsuit. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Kim Lewis. Russian forces have ramped up attacks in eastern Ukraine in an attempt to gain ground near two key frontline cities. President Volodymyr Zelensky warned Ukrainians on Sunday to prepare for new waves of Russian attacks on infrastructure as winter approached. VOA's Lori London spoke with correspondent Anna Chernikova in Kyiv for details.
You live in Kyiv. What did you experience?
Well, it was quite a stressful Saturday, especially Saturday morning, as I woke up personally of a sound of explosion, and it was quite a strong sound of explosion. It did not sound as a hit, but it sounded as air defense on a missile, particularly because at this point, you can already, like, citizens of Kyiv can already understand what the sound is. And the worst thing is that air raid alarm was not on, so it was very unexpected sound of explosion. No one was ready to that, and the air raid alarm started a couple of minutes after the explosion. According to the air defense and air forces of Ukraine, Russians attacked the capital with a ballistic missile. The reason why air raid alarm was not on is still investigated. As a result of this attack, no casualties were reported and no hits to critical or residential infrastructure. However, 18 residents residential private buildings are reported damaged, as well as private enterprise facility, and the damages were caused by the debris of the missile.
Well, I'm glad you're safe. It sounds very scary and unsettling living in a war zone like this and not expecting that in the capital city for sure. And then an interesting situation in Kherson. This attack in Kyiv came on an important milestone.
Yes, exactly. Saturday was November 11th, and this was an anniversary, 1 year anniversary of the liberation of the city of Kherson from Russian occupation. Last year, Ukrainian armed forces managed to liberate the city, and it was one of the most successful counter-offensive battles for the city and the most successful counter-offensive results of last year. And Russian forces shelled the city of Kherson quite seriously on this anniversary day. According to the Ukrainian officials and local authorities of the city of Kherson, two people were injured and one person was killed during these attacks. The attacks were targeting mostly central part of the city and residential areas and private sector, where also residential buildings are located. And unfortunately, there are a lot of damages as well due to the debris and due to the heat. Also, it was reported that Russian forces hit the central library in the city of Kherson, also in the central part of the city. And according to the reports, a rescue team, it took almost 2 hours to the rescue team to stop the fire in that building. The building is seriously damaged, but no casualties were reported from that side.
Any updates on the front line? I know things are really heating up and President Zelensky's warning everyone to plan for that.
Yeah, well, situation is extremely difficult, extremely tough along the front line. Two main parts of the front line remain under the most intensive fire, and battlefield is quite hot in that areas. We're talking about Kherson region and we're talking about Donetsk region. However, Ukrainian armed forces reported that Ukrainian army managed to actually raise, as it was reported, the Ukrainian flag in the gray zone of the Kharkiv region, which is also on the border of Kharkiv region and Donetsk region. It was reported that this zone was under both Russian and Ukrainian control. It was changing, and this territory is called gray zone since the last liberation of Kharkiv region last year by the Ukrainian forces. So at this point, this area is under Ukrainian control, and was also confirmed by the Ukrainian officials that Ukrainian military controls this area but is not constantly staying in that area.
That was Anna Chernikova in Kyiv speaking with VOA's Lori London. The European Union has condemned stepped-up fighting in Sudan's Darfur region, warning of the danger of another genocide after conflict there between 2003 and 2008 killed some 300,000 people and displaced an estimated 2 million people. Sama Salman, a Sudanese strategic analyst and president of the U.S. Education Sudanese Association, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam heavy fighting in Darfur began in June.
We saw the initial peak in violence in Darfur on June 16th. And that is when the RSF, or the Rapid Support Forces, that are being led by General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who is head of the paramilitary army, which was previously known as the Janjaweed, and Khamis Abu Bakr, the governor of West of Darfur, is basically abducted and killed hours after he spoke to one of the Gulf TV stations and described the killings being carried out by the RSF as genocide. You know, about a month later, the U.S. sanctioned Abdelrahim Dagalo. What is really unfortunate is that RSF commander Abdurrahman Juma is one of the commanders who's led the recent wave of violence in Al Junaina. And so what's going on now is that there is a vicious killing of many members of the Messali tribe in the Al Junaina city of West Darfur.
What is with the Messali community that the RSF is going after these people again? I mean, these are men and women and children, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, they go after them by burning their villages, killing the men and raping the women. So we're seeing a repeat of huge amounts of atrocities and war crimes, including gender and sexual based violence. This systematic killing and displacement of the Messali is not new. It follows decades of basically the Messali and other similar tribes. And these are basically sedentary tribes who have been involved in tensions with some of the pastoralist tribes. And so what happened is that 20 years ago,
we saw a huge number of Arab tribal militias fighting with many of the pastoralist indigenous tribes, such as the Masalit. And the fight was over land and diminishing water resources. You also had a situation where these groups, such as the Masalit, they had been marginalized also for many years. So many of these tribal leaders took up arms against Bashir. And what Bashir did, he responded very swiftly by quelling these armed movements and by also sending forces, militia forces like the Janjaweed, which is now headed up in its rebranded, more evolved form known as the RSF. So what you really have is you have an ethnic fight overlaid with a fight for fertile land and resources.
That is Sama Salman, a Sudanese strategic analyst and president of the U.S. Education Sudanese Association. She was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam.
This is Science in a Minute.
Around 66 million years ago, nearly three-quarters of the world's plant and animal species, including the dinosaurs, were destroyed in what is called the Cretaceous-Paleogene extinction event. The most popular theory about the cause of this disaster is known as the Chicxulub impact. It was a 10-kilometer-wide asteroid that crashed into what is now Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. A new study published in the journal Nature Geoscience suggests that ultrafine micrometric silica dust from crushed rock ejected by the Chicxulub impact probably contributed to global climate cooling and disrupted photosynthesis that followed the event. These conditions made it impossible for plants to grow, which in turn led to extreme food shortages that starved plant-eating animals, leading to the extinction of many animal species, including the dinosaurs. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Kim Lewis, wishing you a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For weeks, garment workers in Bangladesh have taken to the streets to protest low wages. The response by the authorities has been severe. At least two workers have been killed in deadly clashes. The United States condemns the violence against workers in Bangladesh. On November 8th, State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said in a statement, "We were saddened by the reported killing by police last week of Rasel Howlader, a 26-year-old factory worker and union member from Somalito Garment Ceramic Federation. Additionally, we mourn the loss of Imran Hossein, a 32-year-old factory worker who died in a fire set by protesters inside a Dhaka factory. We extend our condolences to their families and the greater labor communities." Spokesperson Miller also expressed concern about the ongoing repression of workers and trade unionists. In its most recent report on the human rights situation in Bangladesh, the State Department said that among serious human rights abuses in Bangladesh were significant restrictions on independent trade unions and workers' rights to freedom of association and collective bargaining. In his statement, spokesperson Miller commended members of the private sector who have endorsed union proposals for a reasonable wage increase. The United States, he said, urges the tripartite process to revisit the minimum wage decision to ensure that it addresses the growing economic pressures faced by workers and their families. A tripartite committee exists in Bangladesh with representatives from the government, workers, and employers to review the demands of workers and monitor labor law violations. Governments must ensure workers are able to exercise their rights to freedom of association and collective bargaining without fear of violence, reprisal, or intimidation, said spokesperson Miller. Through our work in Bangladesh and globally, we are firmly committed to advancing these fundamental human rights. The protests by workers and the violent response by the authorities in Bangladesh are taking place just months before the general election, scheduled for January. Speaking of the election, State Department Principal Deputy Spokesperson Vidant Patel reiterated what the United States desires for the Bangladeshi people, which he said is what the Bangladeshi people want for themselves, a free and fair election conducted in a peaceful manner. We are engaging and will continue to engage with the government, with opposition candidates, with civil society and other stakeholders to urge them to work together for the benefit of the Bangladeshi people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.